Hey folks, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. Okay, interesting story about how we got to Keith. Listener, friend of the program, he goes by the name Baby on the message boards, runs a winery in Paso Robles, California called Vines on the Merry Crest, and he blasts WFMU in the tasting room of the winery 24 hours a day. I think somewhere on the website it says something like, you know, come see us, and if the music is too loud, tell us and we'll turn it down. It's just a very music-centered business, and they have concerts there. It's, you know, it's a venue and a winery. So this girl walks into the winery, and he's blasting music, and they start talking about music. And she says, "Oh, you might know my dad. He's Keith." And so he says, "Oh, you know, there's this guy in WFMU who should probably interview Keith." And they exchange contact information, and he tells me about it. And then a few weeks later, my phone rings one night. And some guy says, "Hey, is this Mike from the radio?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, and you're supposed to be a friend of Victor's?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, this is Keith." And I said, "Okay, how's it going?" He said, "It's going good." I was like, "Yeah, what's going on?" And I had no idea that I was talking to Keith, the singer. I just thought I was talking to some guy named Keith. I did not put together that it was the Keith. And then I did, and we had a laugh, and it turns out nicest guy. Keith was just a totally nice guy, and here we are chatting about his 1960s career. And to me, I love chapters like this in rock history. Just, you know, a guy who had undeniable top 10 hits, had a kind of a career, just such a red hot time in the music industry, and his records are really sound amazing. If you're not familiar with the first, you know, three Keith albums, run out and get them. They're really interesting. So, you know, hope you enjoy this. Stay in touch, please. I'm Michael S. at WFMU.org. And if you run into somebody who you think I should interview, tell me ASAP, like listener Baby did. That's it. I want to also remind you, there is a unbleeped curse word in here. I think it's called the S word. If you want to listen to it bleeped, check out the archive of this program over at WFMU.org/Michael. There is Keith and the Admiration's Caravan of Lonely Men, and we've got Keith on the telephone. Good morning, Keith. How are you?
Hey, Michael. Good to be here.
I love that record. That's the earliest thing I could find on you, and I think you're like 15 or something when you made that record. I know you were born in Philadelphia. Tell me how you got from being born to making a record like that as a teenager on the Columbia label.
When I was in fifth or sixth grade, I auditioned for a part. We used to do what they called operettas. The underclassmen would put these shows on monthly for the upperclassmen. So the teacher went down the row, and she was playing the piano, and you had to sing a little something. I forget what it was, but I was behind Richard Ears Kennedy because of the alphabet order, and he missed the cut, and I hit a few notes and verses, and they said, "You're going to be the lead in our operetta." And I went, "Wow." So that started. I performed in all the variety shows and was being taken to lunch by the sophomore and senior girls. I said, "This is really nice." So after that, as I got into high school, I formed an a cappella group with a lot of the guys that were in my class, and spent the nights going to sleep with my transistor radio, listening to The Geeter with the Heater, Jerry Blavitt, and all those old doo-wop songs. And that's basically started my drive and passion to get into the music business. I did some dances. Cal Rudman, if you know who he is, used to throw these hops at a place called St. Eugene's, and I would go there and dance. And when I had one of my bands ready to go, we got up and performed. And at that time, a guy named Jerry Ross, who was a local Philadelphia producer, would bring his acts, the Dream Lovers and the Duprees and bands like that, to perform. And Cal said, I'm going to introduce you to Jerry. And, you know, he's a big wig in Philly. Let's see what happens. So Jerry heard us and said, we're going up to New York and we're going to record a couple of songs. We did. They were put out. Columbia at that time had like Andy Williams and people in that category.
Mitch Miller, yeah.
Yeah. So the promotion on what was kind of a new vein for them wasn't as intense as it could have been. And the record had very minimal sales.
That's so interesting. Your voice on it is so, so radio ready. You know, was that just something you were born with, you think?
I guess, but I attribute it, when I was in that fifth and sixth grade, I was a big Elvis, early Elvis fan. And I would sit in, I lived in an apartment with my dad and his mom, and there was a, it was an old doctor's office, so there was a long hallway going down to the entrance, and it had great echo, and I would play guitar and taught myself and would do Elvis tunes, and I think that kind of set the stage for the vocals that I did, plus listening to all the old doo-wop stuff, the Five Satins, and it kind of gave me the impetus to maybe copy that kind of style.
That's so interesting. I guess I hear a little bit of that, although it's kind of the next link in the chain from that. You know, you're clearly not doing in your career, that's, you know, doo-wop is not your thing, but it's a seed in what grew out of there. So if I've got this right, Jerry Ross, who produced that first 45, moves over to the Mercury label and he brings you over. And I'm sure you were excited about that. What were Mercury's expectations? Did they say, kid, we're going to make you a star? I mean, tell me about being, you're still probably a teenager at this time. What was the record label expecting from your career?
Well, I had recorded some things after Caravan, which I might add, I was a huge Drifters fan, and that song reminded me of a Drifters song, so that was kind of my approach to that song. He went to Mercury, and we had recorded a couple other things, Ain't Gonna Lie, which was my first release on Mercury, and 98.6, and months went by, and I never heard, you know, I never heard anything until at least 6 or 8 months later, I hear Ain't Gonna Lie on WIBG, and I was impoverished. I was living with like three guys and a couple of girls in an apartment, and, you know, it was the bottom of the barrel for me. And here I hear my, and I'm telling these guys, I go, that's me, and they're going, get the hell out of here. And I said, no, that is, you know. So I was doing some hops with some of the DJs there, and Jerry Wright was, I had a show for him at some location, and I walked in, and back then I was notoriously late, and he goes, where you been? And I said, Jerry, I just want to mention, I said, my song is like number 75 on the Wibbitz charts. He goes, get up on stage. So it was like nobody believed me. So I contacted Mercury, and they had just hired a new A&R guy, Dennis Ganem, and he was like 2 weeks into the job in Chicago. And I called there, and he got on the phone. He goes, where are you? He goes, we've been looking all over for you. Your record's getting a lot of airplay. So they put me on a plane and flew me to Chicago and did a bunch of, you know, bio stuff and all that, pictures. And that was the beginning. And Dennis later told me, he said when he took the job, there was an in pile and an out pile of records that had been submitted to the previous A&R guy, and mine was in the out pile, as well as the Blues Magoos, Ain't Got Nothing Yet, if you ever remember that. And he pulled them out of the out pile and was basically responsible for getting the A&R people to get on the bandwagon.
Yeah, well, thank goodness for that guy. So let's talk about the recording. I mean, those are such huge, those two songs you mentioned, they're both such huge sounding records. The playing, you know, the rhythm section is great, the recording is pristine, the horn sections are great, and the horn arranging is great, the singing is fantastic. Did you sing live? Were you there for the tracking? How did the recording go?
Jerry gets all the credit for that. He had a stable of the top-notch New York musicians that he used, and Jimmy Wizard, arranger, and Joe Renzetti, arranger, just were fabulous.
Yeah.
I would go in, we'd lay down some basic tracks, basically live, and he would sweeten it up, you know, after that. Yes.
Oh, that's incredible. So how many, like, for 98.6, how many takes of those songs did you do? Just a couple?
At three at the max. If Jerry wanted something specific or, you know, change some lines or whatever. Yeah, it was pretty straightforward.
And to get back to your voice, to me, you know, your voice is like one of those 60s, sort of like, you know, the Turtles or Mickey Dolenz, like, they just sort of sound like 60s pop coming out of the radio, like you were just born to come out of a radio. Were folks saying to you, kid, you are, you know, your voice is really something special, or was it just taken for granted at the time?
I think, you know, we were just going full speed ahead, you know, there weren't too many accolades. Uh-huh. It was all business, you know.
Sure. So how were the songs presented to you? Did you hear demos, or did someone run them down on a piano, or how did that work?
It happened both ways. 98, I was given a demo. I remember my wife at the time, I was in, there was no room at the Wellington in New York, so they put me in a cot in the boiler room down in the bottom of the hotel. And I remember calling my wife, and she said, "So what's going on?" I said, "I just recorded a song called 98.6. I go, I don't think this thing's going anywhere, you know.
And that was probably the temperature in the room down in the boiler room.
Yeah, probably.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that, you know, Keith is not your born name, and in some ways, Keith is like a character who isn't exactly you, and the sound of the first couple of Keith records is this very specific 60s pop sound. It's this huge, you know, I love it, you know. Was that something?
Yeah, they're great, fabulous productions.
Yes, I agree, totally fabulous. Was this something they were trying to manufacture, or was it a sound that developed, you know, because it suited your voice and your personality? Or is that too obtuse a question?
I don't think I was that involved. You know, it was just the stable of writers that he had, Tony Powers, George Fischoff, you know, those guys were just like machines. And, you know, it just was like kismet.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I agree. The songs too. I should admit. Yeah. Those songs play such a big part in that whole sound. So when it was done, you mentioned, you know, when it was recorded but not released, you mentioned you called your wife at the time and said, "I don't know." You know, what did you think? Did you think I better go get a job, or, you know, what exactly were your expectations?
Well, after the acapella period, the Beatles came out and all that, and I was like trying to get my guys, who were basically singers, to get into playing some instruments, because I already played guitar, and that didn't work. So I had put some, in a search in the Philadelphia area, found musicians, and now I had a band, a full functioning band. And at that point, we started doing fraternities and that kind of stuff, full on. So I was more engrossed into rock and roll than I was into the pop scene. So in my mind, that was just not me, you know? I was more into Eric Burdon and, you know, the Zombies and those were the songs that we would perform at the frat houses. So that's why I had questioned the validity of the song, because it wasn't in my vein, per se.
Gotcha. Interesting. Ain't Gonna Lie was a number 39, hit 98.6, was a million seller, reached number 7. Tell Me to My Face, a Fantastic Hollies cover, was also top 40. I mean, that's pretty amazing for a debut album for such a young guy. Was everybody head over heels thrilled once the machine got going?
Yeah. I mean, we just kept rolling. You know, I went out and started doing Dick Clark tours and performing all over the states. It was a fantastic time, you know.
One of the things that you mentioned about the time, to me, having a hit record, a top 10 in 1967, is really something, because the charts were so competitive with good records. You know what I mean? There was no...
Oh, I know.
So you really pulled something off. You mentioned to me off the air that you had played on bills with the Beach Boys. In those days, tell me about touring in those days, what it was like, and any other bands that you shared bills with that impressed you?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Beach Boys, the funny thing about them, and I did like 6 months of tours with them, one night they would be fantastic, and I mean, just flawless. And then... two nights later, I mean, they sounded horrible. It was like, I'm going, what's this all about, you know? Question Mark and the Mysterians, their whole dressing room, which was next to ours, was just filled with the smell of marijuana. Stevie Wonder, I did a show with him. There's just...
What fun!
Yeah, it was. And the Keith thing that you asked me, the a cappella bands that I had were like Keef, K-E-I-F, and the Shadows, Keef and the Belairs. And when Jerry and I hooked up, he said, well, Keef is a Moroccan drug. We can't use that name, you know? And I thought, well, it's the 60s. It's fabulous. And he said, you're going to be Keef. And that's how that came about.
Oh, interesting. So you're getting tons of attention. You're rubbing elbows with, you know, superstars. I assume you had, you know, money. You went from sleeping on the floor with 20 roommates to having some money. Were you prepared for the attention, the pressure of having the spotlight on you?
No, because I think that attention that I got in grade school, you know, from those senior and junior and sophomore ladies, kind of prepared me for that, you know, in a strange way. So it was an interesting transition, I guess would be the word.
Yeah. One of the things, then, this was so typical of the mid-60s, is that your second album, Out of Crank, comes out the same year as your first album. You know, in this day and age, they would kind of wring every drop out of an album before they put another one out. Was that a strategy you were on board with back then?
Yeah, I mean, I was up for anything and everything, and because I was working so much on the road, you know, they had to squeeze in whenever I wasn't working, per se, to get into the studio and record. So, yeah, and Jerry knew what he was doing. He had the guys working full-time writing.
Yeah, so what is Out of Crank? What does the album title mean?
Originally, it was representing the crank of an automobile back in the 20s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically it. That's why the head is circling on the album cover.
That's so interesting. Mercury Records, did they treat you well? Did you have a good deal? A lot of times when people are young and sign a deal, they don't sign the world's best deal, legally speaking. How did you do?
I made most of my money on the road, so I was pulling in like 15 grand a week, and back then that was a lot of bread. So
yeah, not bad at all.
No, so yeah, that's where my money came from. But I was doing the same 6% deals that they had back then, and you paid all the sessions and out of your royalties. So that aspect of it wasn't as lucrative as going out and playing.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of times the public think you must be a billionaire because you had a top 10 song, but it doesn't always work out that way.
No, not in any case. I mean, Quiet Riot. You know, they made a bunch of money.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah,
they did. They made millions.
Yeah. So a couple more singles on Mercury, and then you moved to RCA in 1969 for the album The Adventures of Keith, which is still, it still has that kind of lush Keith sound, and the singing is still huge, but it's a little more psychedelic. The main difference for me about that record, which I also really love, is that you co-wrote, I think, all of the songs, or wrote all the songs. So how is it that you blossomed as a songwriter? Where did that seed come from?
Back to the Stairway at the doctor's office. I started writing back then, and my old drummer, I went back to Philly for my 70th birthday to see an Eagles game, and he has all of those demos from Frank Virtue's studio of another dozen songs that I wrote in that little hallway. So I've been writing all along, but that was the problem I had with Mercury. I wanted a chance, because at that time mostly everybody was writing their own stuff, and that's what I wanted to do. So that kind of severed my relationship with Jerry and Mercury.
Gotcha. That's very interesting. Any plans to release those demos?
Oh, I sound like I'm 7 years old.
Well, I'd like to hear them. The next thing that is super, super fascinating to me, you are arrested for draft evasion, I believe, in the middle of a concert tour. When was this, and how long were you confined for?
That was, what was that? That was, I don't know, 68, I believe, 1968. I had misread my draft dealy that they sent me in the mail, and it said 8 o'clock, so I went at 8 in the morning, and they said, no, it's 8 at night. So I had a gig, and I just never went back.
And so they arrested you. What did they do with you? Did they throw you in a regular jail?
Yeah, I was in a jail in New York for a day, and then I went, they sent me to Fort Dix, and I was there for, I don't know, a month or so, with Carmen Appice was in there at the same time.
Wow. And was RCA fighting to get you out of there, or what was happening?
Yeah. Jerry was trying, and, you know, it finally all got squashed and settled, and was a big misunderstanding, so I spent some time peeling potatoes and making coffee for the generals, is what I did.
That's incredible. You know, it is such a story of all the guys your age, all those bands, you know, the Beach Boys too. Every guy was trying to stay out of being drafted. And I don't know if I've, you know, you don't hear too many stories about guys who actually got arrested and, for it.
Well, my popularity really helped me, you know. It gave me easy jobs, and I never left Fort Dix.
Gotcha. Did that in some ways make you an anti-hero? Did that improve your standing with teenagers?
I never got any notification of that kind of stuff, but I was just happy to have it all behind me, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. You toured and recorded with Frank Zappa, and he's such an interesting guy. How'd you hook up with him?
Well, Leonard Stogel was my manager in New York through Jerry. And his vice president was Zach Lichtman. And Zach, Lenny and his wife died in the in a Chicago TWA plane crash. So that did away with that business. So Zach moved out here and hooked up with Herb Cohen, who was the manager of Linda Ronstadt, Frank, Tom Waits. And Mark and Howard had just left. And Zach said, we want to get Frank to be more commercial, so we're going to put you with him. And I went, okay. So that's how we got together. I flew down. They were doing gigs, and they were rehearsing on stage. I went down, I think it was Nashville or somewhere, and introduced myself. And He gave me like 8 sheets of lyrics and said, okay, learn these and, you know, we'll start tomorrow. No melodies, no anything, just a bunch of words. And he came by my hotel room that night and was playing. I brought my axe with me, and he was playing, and I had listened to all the albums, you know, did my homework. But obviously this was all new stuff for the Grand Wazoo was the album that they were working on at that time. And he came into my room and grabbed my guitar and started playing and sounded like crap. I'm going, geez, this is Frank Zappa. And I don't know whether it was my guitar or what, but he looked at me and he said, I heard your stuff, but I don't know if you really want to even sing this shit.
Hmm.
And I went, Frank's calling his own stuff crap, you know. I said, no, let's give it a go. So we basically became brothers. We went everywhere together. The guy was the most normal individual you would ever want to meet for being in the business. Drank an urn of coffee a day, didn't smoke, didn't drink. Just a passionate musician, you know.
Yeah, that's nice to hear.
He was a great guy.
Eventually, you started your own label, still playing gigs, and then eventually you kind of drifted into working into television production, and that's kind of still what you're doing today, you know, out in California. Is playing shows something that you're interested in doing these days?
You know, every couple of months I'll get an offer from, you know, a nostalgia show promoter or something. But primarily they're on the East Coast, and the money isn't really that good compared to what I'm making doing what I'm doing now, you know? Mm. So I've kind of fluffed it off. But, I mean, you never say never. I mean, if there was something that would be lucrative and fun, of course, I'd be more than happy.
Mm. You know, I mentioned earlier sort of just being in that, you know, pantheon of 60s hit makers to me is a huge deal. And I was curious. I looked up some of the songs that were also in the top 10 when 98.6 was in the top 10. And Monkees, I'm a Believer, Georgie Girl by the Seekers, Tell It Like It Is by Aaron Neville, Kind of a Drag by the Buckinghams, The Four Tops, Standing in the Shadow of Love, Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones, The Beat Goes On by Sonny and Cher, you know, and Keith, 98.6. It's like, those are, you know,
I was in good company.
Yeah, it's a mind-blowing, you know, bunch of records. And to me, that's so huge. Do you wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and go, hey, there's Keith, that guy who is part of that long list?
From day one, reflecting back, I mean, I have been so blessed. I mean, to have been and have done the things that I've done throughout my life, it just seems like there are some nights I wake up and I go, how did I get on stage at the Scene in New York with Jimi Hendrix on bass, Keith Moon on keyboards, Carmen Appice on drums, Noel Redding playing guitar, and doing midnight shows, you know? It's like, how does that happen? I mean, it's just a blessed life I've lived.
Ah, well, that's so great to hear somebody with that attitude after all these times. But, you know, don't forget, it really is your voice that is the special thing. And but I'm glad to hear that you have a humble take on it. Do you ever get sick of hearing 98.6? I don't know. Do you ever, like, walk in the supermarket and hear it or, you know, just hear it on the radio somewhere? And, you know, do you still feel good about it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll get a call once a month from somebody from somewhere holding up a phone at the supermarket or the you know, or in an elevator, or you know, it's been 55 years, and it's amazing.
That's it. Well, you're so young when you recorded this, so you're still so young now. Before we hear this song, is there anything else that we need to know about the recording or the legacy of it?
No, it was just as I said, kismet that it happened and that I got to where I got and did what I did.
Yeah. Keith, thank you so much. This has been a total pleasure.
Michael, it's been my pleasure. It's always good to talk to you.
shining. I know my baby brought you to me. She kissed me yesterday, hello, your silver lining. Got spring and summer running through me. Hey, 98.6, it's good to have you back again. Oh, hey, 98.6, her loving is the medicine that saved me. Oh, I love my baby. Hey, everybody on the street, I see you smiling. Must be because I found my baby. You know she's got me on another kind of highway. I want to go to where it takes me. Hey, 98.6, it's good to have you back again. Oh, hey, 98.6, her loving is the medicine that saved me. Oh, I love my baby. You know she's got me on another kind of highway. I want to go to where it takes. 98.6, it's good to have you back again. Oh, hey, 98.6, her loving is the medicine that saved me. Oh, I love my baby.